First, though, science news, and it's a pungent aroma and a strong flavour that enhances so much of our food these days. But Australia's love of the humble garlic clove might be putting other plants at risk. With domestic producers unable to keep up with demand, most of our garlic now comes from overseas, from countries as far afield as China, Mexico and Spain. But some new research shows that these imported bulbs are carrying dozens of viruses that are going unchecked. Earlier, I spoke with our regular science guru, Chris Smith.
Morning, Fran.
Now, Chris, this sounds quite scary, particularly given, I know I can barely cook anything without using garlic. What is the extent of this problem and these viruses?
I was surprised to learn from Steve Wiley, who's a researcher at Murdoch University, who published this paper in PLOS One just in the last week, that Australia is importing 3,500 tonnes of garlic every year because domestic production accounts for only 10% of the demand. And it's gone up 70% in the last decade or so. Steve says, I blame Jamie Oliver, but I think there are other people who are also equally fond of garlic, which have been pushing the garlic agenda. But basically, it's a very big import. And why it's an issue is that garlic comes as a bulb. And if people buy this from the shops, which is what they did in their study, they just went to the supermarket and bought garlic, you can propagate it in the garden. And once you propagate the plant, then any viruses that it's carrying can be spread to other plants. And that's because little insects come along and they drink the sap of the garlic plant, and they can then carry any viruses that enables them to pick up off to other plants, in the same way that a mosquito can bite a human and transmit various viruses amongst humans.
So what is the danger of these viruses, though? Do they pose a danger to other plants, or are they a risk to human health?
Well, they're not a direct risk to human health because these are plant viruses and they can only infect and grow in plant cells. But they found 41 different virus isolates from a small number of garlics bought at the local supermarket. And they range from several different classes of different plant viruses. But why they may have an impact on humans is economically, because they could spread to other crops upon which we rely both for financial income to sell these plants and also to feed ourselves. And they can be transmitted by insect vectors, as I've explained. So there is a potential indirect risk to humans with this.
So, Chris, is the danger, sorry, just to be clear, the danger not so much that the viruses that are on the bulbs in the supermarket, but only if those bulbs are then replanted and propagated and that's where the insects come in? I mean, how many of us are actually trying to grow garlic in our backyards from the bulbs we buy in the supermarket?
Well, quite a few, but it doesn't take very many people to grow the garlic or for the garlic to be propagated in just in the wild, because people throw it away. You don't need very much growing for it to be a source of these viruses, and then the insects can come in and pick up the viruses and transmit them to other native species or other plants grown commercially in Australia. I think that there's a wider implication here because there appears to be a sort of policy loophole, and I was speaking to Steve Wiley yesterday, and he was saying, well, the way they detected this was by going to the supermarket, buying some garlic, grinding the garlic up, extracting the DNA from the garlic, which will include the DNA of any microorganisms that are in there, and then genetically sequencing it, and then comparing those genetic sequences to the database, showing that these viruses are there and they're potentially viable. Now, he's saying that if countries like Australia are importing from all over the world various foodstuffs like this, then there's quite a high risk that other things are going to come in too, because at the moment there's very strict quarantine laws regarding various aspects of food practice and food import and export. But this has been overlooked and probably needs looking at because it may
have an impact. Garlic, but is this just garlic that's getting through, that not being checked? Because as you say, there's quite a high quarantine wall in Australia generally for foodstuffs.
And it would appear, at this time they know this is true of garlic, but there probably are other things that are also creeping through. And so he's saying we need to look at this. But then I said to him, well, is that practical? Because obviously it took a laboratory and a lot of his time to do this piece of work. How is it practical to test enormous volumes of food and drink potentially for this sort of threat? But it is something we should be worried about, because as more and more material and more people move around the planet, more and more infections have the potential to move around the planet. We talk about humans spreading infections, but the food that we eat is also potentially very important too.
And this is ironic, because a lot of us eat more garlic because we think it's good for us. Chris, in other science news, we know our brains are wired to associate certain places with good and bad memories, but now some US scientists are saying they might be able to alter this association. How would that be done?
There's a paper in Nature this week. It's by Roger Redondo, who's a researcher at MIT. This is intriguing what they've done, because they've been able to show that just as, and the example that's also given in Nature in a lovely News and Views article by one of the people who discovered the technique that was used in this paper, they're actually saying, we all know that if you have dinner in a restaurant and it's a fond occasion with a partner you love, then you associate that place with those fond memories. But if something then subsequently goes wrong in the relationship, then the memory can turn sour. So how do we attach a good or a bad association to a place? They've been looking at two regions in the brain. There's one called the hippocampus, because it looks in humans a bit like a seahorse. This is involved in memory formation and also in our understanding of where we are in the environment. It's our place setting, if you like. And another region called the amygdala, because it looks a bit like an almond. Neuroanatomists are imaginative people. And that's what amygdala means. That is where we make judgments about whether things are good or bad. And what they've done in mice is to take groups of mice and then teach them an association with a place, either a good association by allowing them to hang out with a female mouse for a while, and that produces a good memory, or a bad memory. They give them an electric shock in that place. Then, using a clever technique called optogenetics, they're able to activate, using light, specifically the nerve cells that were activated by those memories. So just the memory of whether it's a good or a bad memory, and just the memory of where that that association occurred. And what they're able to do is reverse the memory in the mice by either turning on or turning off these exclusively these groups of cells. And so a mouse that had a bad memory for that place, you can selectively replace the good memory with a bad memory by using this light technique. And what this is revealing to them is that the brain has one set of memories which encode where something happens and a very different set of memories that encode whether it's good or bad, and the two are coupled together. So you can disentangle the two and then flip a good for a bad or a bad for a good, but the memory of the place and the memory of good or bad remain independent. They're just connected together. So it's a bit like two different labels. They're not one single memory, a good memory of what happened in a location or a bad memory of what happened in a location.
The brain, what an amazing place it is to explore. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Smith, and you can hear more of Chris on The Naked Scientist every Friday night at 10 o'clock right here on RN.